This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Our guest today is acclaimed bass player, composer, conductor, arranger, and producer Stanley Clark. He was born in Philadelphia in 1951, attended school and college in the city, and for a time aspired to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Well, that didn't happen. Instead, he went on to revolutionize bass playing with his signature style and to take the instrument from the shadows and put it up front where it belongs. He began his career playing with Art Blakey, Dave Brubeck, and Dexter Gordon before forming Return to Forever with keyboardist Chick Corea. He's collaborated with many different musicians, composed movie scores, and received numerous awards and honors, including 4 Grammys. He has a new CD, The Stanley Clark Band Up. We'll play selections from the new album and from past hits and talk about his long and accomplished career. Many excited people in the building today. Stanley Clark, nice to have you with us on Radio
Times.
Hey,
it's good. It's good to see you. I was here yesterday and I saw a lot of friends, and it seems like everywhere I go, you know, I meet someone that I grew up with. There's a fellow here that I met.
Yeah, Al Banks. Yeah, lived down the street from you, right?
Right up the street. And so it's it's always nice to come back to Philadelphia.
Do you think there's a Philly sound? I mean, they talk about that with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Do you think there's a Philly sound when it comes to other kinds of music?
Well, you know, yes, of course. I think there's a Philly culture, you know, artistic cultures. If you were here back in the 60s, the school systems here, you know, a very important thing was music, art, and dance. I remember I was a part of this thing called the All City program. They had all the orchestras, All City Junior High School Orchestra. And at the end of the year, there was something called Schools on Parade, where all the schools would get together and have this big concert. And, you know, that was something that was really unique to Philadelphia. And I met many musicians that I still work with today from those programs, you know. So, yeah, there is something special about Philly in art.
Well, and I was reading about you that you ended up playing the bass sort of by accident. It was the last instrument that was being handed out at the school you were attending?
Yeah, I think I was going to, I think it was a school called Levering Elementary School. And, you know, they wanted to know what kids wanted to play instruments, you know. So I went to the music room, and I was a little late. So all these so-called, quote-unquote, good instruments were taken, right? And finally, what was left was like a bass drum and a sousaphone and an acoustic bass. Now, the acoustic bass was sitting in the corner, and the reason why I sort of gravitated toward that instrument was because there was just one. It was it. And so I figured, well, if I play this instrument, you know, I'll be the only one that plays that. And but then when I started playing the instrument, it had the nastiest sound I you could ever hear. And it was like, you know. And so I just sort of made it my life goal to try to make the acoustic bass sound beautiful. And any bass that gets in my hand, I try to make it sound good. So.
And you do have this signature style. I mean, a way that you play the bass is really like nobody else.
Well, that's what they say, you know. I'm a very, I think because of my mother, you know, my upbringing, you know, my mother was used to walk around the house singing opera all the time. She was a great painter as well. And she was very interested in music, and she sort of recognized me at a young age as having some interest in that. And she made sure that I, got into it, and she played music for me. And so I have a melodic sense. So it probably wouldn't have mattered what instrument I played. I would have had, like, however I feel about, you know, whatever my feelings about music are, would have just passed through whatever instrument I had chosen, you know.
Well, I do want to play a selection and talk a bit about this new CD. It's called Up, which is a very happy and optimistic word. Does that reflect how you're feeling these days?
Well, yeah. I mean, not just speaking for myself. I think everyone has a, you know, unless you're really down in the dumps there. I mean, there's always a feeling at some point in the day where you feel up. It's for me right now. You know, my kids have all grown up. My wife's doing great. The family's doing good. I love what I'm doing with music, so I feel pretty good. And I started making this record, and actually the first track that I cut was with my old friend Stuart Copeland, the drummer. And Stuart is one of the most optimistic people you could ever meet. I don't know whether you've ever talked to him before, but he's really optimistic. And so we cut this track, and we were just talking. I said, Stuart, why are you so up, man? Okay, you've had a very successful career. I understand that, but I know guys that are very successful that are not as up as you are and optimistic. So we called the track Up.
Well, and we played that for our Billboard, but I do want to play this clip from this new album called, the clip is called Last Train to Sanity.
Yes.
And let's listen to it, and then we can talk.
Okay.
Last Train to Sanity off the Stanley Clark Band's new album called Up, featuring obviously our guests and the Harlem String Quartet. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a bunch of other people as well. And I have to say, our engineer Kevin just whispered in my ear, I'm in heaven, Marty. What's the genesis of this song?
Well, that's kind of the film composer side of me. You know, like I've done a lot of films, in my life, and there's a side of me that I can look at a situation, and for some reason music comes to my head, or I can look at a situation and sort of transform the situation in my mind by thinking about music. And that's essentially what you do as a film composer, is you look at footage, and maybe a director might say, well, these two people aren't kissing hard enough, so can you come up with something to make them appear like they're kissing more? And for some reason, I have that ability. I don't couldn't tell you why, where it came from. But anyway, this song in particular, Last Train to Sanity, it started out as a little idea. It was a film that actually never got made. Well, started, but they ran out of money. So
So
I had this little germ here, and a little seed or whatever, and it just, I said, it's sitting around, and it was nice, and I was working with the Harlem String Quartet at that time, and I thought, I need to write something for those guys anyway. So all these various ideas came together, and this piece just sort of exploded out of my universe there, and there it is.
Well, in fact, you say in the liner notes, this is one of the best pieces you've ever written.
Yeah, it was, because the idea of the piece was crystallized in my head, and it was kind of like going down a check sheet. It was kind of like, imagining a really interesting building, and you can see it in your mind in full detail, like what the stairs, windows, carpeting, what everything's going to look like. And so some might say, well, now that I've crystallized it in my head, why do I have to do it?
Right, right.
You know, so this was like that, and I thought, you know, I need to do this. And so I had this new program called Sibelius, which is a program that you use with the computer to do musical scores. And so this was the first thing that I wrote using that.
As you said, you've done a lot of movie music and scores for films, and it's something that you really love to do. And is it? I mean, it must be an interesting challenge. I'm not sure how it works. Whether you're looking at a scene, and you're trying to figure out, and how do we sort of underscore what's going on in this particular scene?
You know, it starts like this. Kind of early on, you may read a script, and a script kind of gives you an idea of, you know, what the story is going to be about. You may come up with some ideas, but actually not until you get the footage are you going to really know what's happening, because many things change from that process, from script to having a final cut, you know. So once you look at the footage, you know, sometimes, you know, you can have the greatest actors in the world, but there'll be certain parts of the film that need music. Like, I would like to define film music as the glue in a movie. It can propel you through a movie. Sometimes you may have a scene that takes place on Monday, then there's a hard cut that goes to Friday, but you may need like a musical bridge to go from one scene to the other, and that's you know, I mean, there's many other things. We talked a little earlier about, you know, one of the things I like about film composing is that I get a chance to write music using all the emotional tones. Like, you can write music that goes from complete death, destruction, everything, you know, all the way up to serenity of beingness, you know, nirvana, and all the various tones and emotions in between. And as a composer, that's really, really nice. That's a lot of stuff to work with.
About a minute before our first break here, when you go to the movies, do you have your own music score that you play in your head?
Well, to be quite honest, you know, it's difficult sometimes for me to go to movies. I'll be really honest, because I see things that other... Because I've done over 50 films, you know, and many, 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 many television shows. So when I look at movies, I can tell you something. I have seen films where I've seen the microphone at the very top. Have you seen them before?
I'm
always looking for the little microphone, or I'll see something like some inconsistency where the guy has a red shirt on and this, but it's supposedly the same day and he's got a blue shirt on. Like, you know, all those kind of things I notice. So sometimes the movies, I tell you that for some reason I don't care when I see mindless action movies. You know, I know they're messed up already. So I watch them and I can kind of like, yeah, okay, this is great.
That's Stanley Clarke, our guest. We're talking about movies and music. He's a Grammy Award-winning bass player, producer, composer, also a Philadelphia native. And he has a new album. It's called Up. We're going to play some more music. We're going to talk some more. And again, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase Cancer Center and other cancer centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, your first choice in cancer care.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Also, Sprach Zarathustra with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Vladimir Yurovsky conducts Richard Strauss's famous showpiece. And young Russian violinist Alina Ibragimova plays Mozart's fourth violin concerto. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, also Sprach Zarathustra resounds throughout the Kimmel Center with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Westtown believes that students and their parents deserve a school that offers academic rigor and an uncommon level of connection. You can learn more about Westtown's acclaimed programs and 600-acre campus by attending their open house on Sunday, November 2nd at 1 p.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westtown is a Quaker, college prep, pre-K through 12th grade day and boarding school in Westchester. Westtown School proudly supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Stanley Clark, who has been called by some a base liberator. He did take the base, from the shadows from the back and has moved it up front. He's been performing and composing since 1971, grew up here in Philadelphia. And again, he's got a new album that has just come out, and it's called The Stanley Clark Band Up. And I do want to play another clip from the Stanley. This is the Brazilian Love Affair composition by the late George Duke. He died just a bit more than a year ago. Someone that you worked with quite a bit.
Yeah. Me and George, we met in 1971, and we from that point until now, we've managed to get as much time together playing as possible. He was definitely, George was probably one of the most loved musicians. He was, you know, there's lots of musicians, you know, that play great, but there's some that play great and that are like really loved for some reason. And these reasons, for, you know, as far as George was concerned, he was one of these guys that could embrace any musician and embrace whatever genre he was in. George, like, his footprints went across all the different genres. Mm-hmm. He produced many types of records, many people from different walks of life, and he was the best guy to be in the studio with.
Really?
Yeah, he was always like cracking jokes, laughing, but at the same time, underneath all that, he was a very extremely serious musician and well capable, and even more so prepared. You know, you never got in a studio with him and, like, you're going, what's happening?
He had it all.
It was all together. So, you know, I miss him, you know. It was a surprise, you know. Well, it's always a surprise when someone like that passes, you know.
Yeah.
He was a great guy.
Do you think of this as Brazilian Love Affair, composition by him?
Yeah.
Do you think of this as a tribute to him?
Well, yeah, it is, because, you know, we went to Brazil many times, and that was probably one of George's favorite places to go down there. He loved the food down there. It's very nice. You know, back in the 70s and the early 80s, Brazil was much different than it is now. It was pretty much like imagine living somewhere where you could leave your doors open and windows open. Not anymore, but
yeah. You could then.
but it was nice. We used to love to go down there, and so whenever I hear this piece or think of it, you know, I have fond memories of George.
Let's listen. This is a Brazilian Love Affair.
Bahia.
and a Brazilian Love Affair, a composition by the late George Duke, one of our guest Stanley Clarke's frequent collaborators off this new Stanley Clarke Band album, Up. And, I mean, it's a very evocative of Brazil. And, yeah. And who were those voices that we're hearing?
My daughter, Natasha.
Oh, really?
A couple of her friends. And yeah, my daughter's a singer. She just finished her own record, too. I'll be sure to send it to you.
Please do. Please do.
And yeah, she's quite the singer. She's good. I think I was a little tough on her, but I told her, in this business you gotta be good. And anyway, she's on there. I sing a little bit there. I was trying to sing like George. Difficult to do, but it's a cool song. It's a good song. Every time I hear it, I think of George. You know.
Well, I was looking at this new album of yours, and I think you have something like 25 different musicians that you play with.
Yeah.
These are all people you've largely played with over the
years.
Yeah,
you know, it's another thing about this record. I thought I was going to, you know, I thought that I would have a lot of my really close friends play on the record. So a lot of these guys are my close friends. And right in the smack in the middle of the record, I realized, you know, I have a lot of really close friends that are musicians, and boy, they're geniuses too. I said, how lucky am I? Right. You know, so that was another byproduct of the project, just that recognition.
When you were a kid growing up in Philadelphia playing the bass, did you practice a lot? I mean, were you one of those really diligent students?
Yeah, I was maybe a little over the top, actually.
Really?
I would practice in the house, out the house, the side of the house. I didn't care if there was a space there and there was a bass there.
You would be
playing. I'm on.
You loved it so much?
Yeah. I wanted to achieve something. I had something very specific in my mind that I wanted to achieve musically. And it was kind of far from where I was at the time when I started.
Yeah.
And I just kept going at it, and then finally got there. So, you know, and now I have other things, other musical ideas with the bass and music and composition and other things that I'm going. I've set other goals, you know, but I was a real serious and avid practicer. Yeah.
And one of your goals was to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Well, you know, like my mother, you know, she wanted me to like, it's funny, I think I've never mentioned this before anywhere, but my mother was not a big fan of my electric music.
Well, sometimes parents are not, right?
I brought my School Days album home. I said, here's a gold record. Here, look, Mom, check this out. She said, why are you doing this music? Why are you doing this?
She didn't hear it?
She didn't even listen to it. She was, you know, classical music, you know. And so, you know, I had this idea that I was going to join the Philly Orchestra, which I wanted to do, and I was preparing for that. But then I met Chick Corea, and he changed that. He came down here to Philadelphia, and we had a talk. And I think he said, what do you want to do that for?
And now how old were you at the time?
I think I was like 18, something like
that. Oh, wow.
He says, you know, why do you want to do that? We're going to have a lot of fun. I said, really?
You and me, right.
And we did.
Well, I do want to get to that chapter, but I do want to play. You have a new rendition of one of your biggest hits, "School Days."
Yeah.
It appeared on your original album?
Yeah, it was a 1976 album called "School Days," I think. Yeah.
Were you? Why did you want to redo this?
It? Yeah. Well, I thought, why not? You know, I know a lot of rock and roll artists they'll have certain songs that they deem to be classics, and they never redo it. Many times, it's because they can't. In my case, I still play School Days, and I thought, well, you know, Miles Davis recorded the song So What 4 or 5 times. John Coltrane recorded many of his songs. I mean, at heart, I'm a jazz musician, so why should I not? Because something's a classic. It's just a word. And I redid it again, and one of the reasons is because the guitar player, many guitar players approach me, and, man, I would love anything to record School Days with you. So this is guy, Jimmy Herring, that plays guitar. He's one of the great Southern rock guitar players now that still have that tradition now. That you can hear it in his sound and his phrasing. And I always loved Jimmy, so I said, hey, let's do School Days. And he was very happy. He said, hey, man, thank you. So that's why we did it.
Let's give it a listen. again, a new rendition of one of Stanley Clarke's biggest hits, School Days. It originally appeared on the 1976 album of the same name, and we were sort of rocking out listening to that. We also got an email from Glenn who says, great show today. I'm a 56-year-old bassist, and Stanley Clarke was a huge influence. When I was called to the bass in my teens, I remember coming to lessons one day. My bass teacher, put on School Days on the turntable after taking in the title track. I looked at my teacher with a puzzled expression on my face. He said, that is the bass.
Okay. All right.
Talk just a bit about, though, how you do play. I realize we're on the radio, and so you can't do your fingers so well on the radio.
I think if someone asks me why do you play the bass the way you do, you know, a lot of it has to do with how I grew up, you know. I was just talking to my friend earlier, you know. I lived in a very unique neighborhood. You know, we had a lot of athletes. We had a beautiful guy that lived a couple doors from me named Bayard Lancaster.
Oh, sure.
Lived three doors from me, and he was when you're 14 and you see someone that introduces you to avant-garde music, you know, like, kind of blows your head open a little bit. So, I think I became a nonconformist like at a very young age. So the bass, when I got the bass, I just didn't understand why I should have to stand in the back behind some guy that doesn't know as much as I do about music. And I remember Bayard Lancaster used to tell me, man, you should write music for the bass. Go out there and, you know.
Put it up front, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, that's basically what I did. You know, a lot of my playing came from my composing, and composing comes from how a person feels, you know, what he feels about music and how he wants to design that music in the physical universe, you know. So, so I wrote music, and I wrote melody for the bass, and I did it. And I'll be honest, there were some people that looked at me like, boy, this is kind of strange, you know. But I just kept doing it. And you know, people, human beings, we love new ideas, things that are fresh. And that's one of the things I love about what we do as a people, you know. And it was just something that was fresh at that time. Not that I was the first bass soloist. There was Charlie Mingus, there was Slam Stewart, but kind of the way I did it, I guess it was unique and people liked it. And I liked it too and enjoyed it. It was and I'm continuing to roll with that. You know?
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Stanley Clarke, our guest today on Radio Times, award-winning bass player, producer, composer, also Philadelphia native. And we're listening to some music and talking, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I was also reading about I guess it was a lunch or dinner or something you had with Charlie Mingus. Mm-hmm. It also seemed to kind of be one of those, you know, seminal meetings.
Yeah, that was a defining moment in my young days. When I came to New York, Charlie had heard about me from someone, and he actually said, let's have a dinner. And so I go to some restaurant downtown. And first of all, I never saw anyone eat so much, you know. Like, I only ate with two people where you sit down at the table and they order platters, not plates. One was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Charlie Mingus had these, like, platters of, like, he'd say, well, I like some corn. You know, I'm like a little bit.
Not little.
No, this
dish
is a platter. I'm like, golly. So, but the thing that struck me about Charlie was his eyes. I got the sense that Charlie could have not been a bass player. He could have been a leader of a small country, you know, hopefully in revolution or something. You know, he was that. He just had a look of fire and determination, and he was a real, like, revolutionary at heart, you know. And he talked about the bass and something. Well, actually, he mainly talked about leadership and composition. And we were going to do something together, like. He wanted to have a concert at Carnegie Hall, and we were going to write some music together. Because he was not drawn to me so much for my bass playing, but because I was a composer. And see, that was the thing with Charlie Mingus. He was a bass player, but really, what he was at heart was a composer.
Mm. He recognized kind of a kindred spirit.
Yeah, he recognized that, and he recognized that that was something that could grow with me. And so we talked a bit about that. And that, you know, whatever that was, whatever I got from that is still with me.
Oh, you feel it even
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Sure.
And do you eat the way Charlie Mingus
does? I don't eat platters. I mean, maybe, you know, I'll tell you, I was kidding with some people earlier. Whenever I came to Philadelphia, I used to eat, just go right down South Street to my favorite steak and hoagie place, Jim's.
Oh, that's Jim's my steak, favorite. Hey.
I used to go down there and get three or four of those, you know, but I don't do that anymore, you know. Sorry, Jim.
Well, let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. You can take it up with Jim after the show.
Sorry, baby.
And again, Stanley Clark is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, acclaimed bass player, composer, conductor, arranger, producer. And again, he's got a new album. It's a new CD called The Stanley Clark Band Up. We're going to play some more music, talk some more, and we'll be right back.
Annenberg Center and Dance Celebration support WHYY and present Ballet Boys, London's cheeky and athletic company of 10 virtuoso male dancers. The troupe fuses energetic and graceful dance with music and film to create its critically acclaimed and distinctive style. Ballet Boys at the Annenberg Center, October 23rd through the 25th. Tickets for Ballet Boys at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org. Annenberg Center and Dance Celebration support WHYY.
The Catholic Foundation of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY. The Catholic Foundation helps support the needs of the entire community with its Helping Hands Fund. The fund works to find new approaches to feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, and bring new opportunities to those who are struggling. More information is available at 215-587-5650 or online at catholicfoundationphila.org. 215-587-5650 or catholicfoundationphila.org.
The Executive MBA at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY and is proud to announce the Executive MBA's relocation to the Hub Commerce Square at 20th and Market Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. In only one weekend per month for 16 months, the Executive MBA is designed to help you expand your leadership and business skills needed to succeed in a complex global economy. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/EMBA.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. If you're just joining us, Stanley Clark is our guest. He has a new CD, the Stanley Clark Band Up, and he grew up here in Philadelphia, attended school here in the city, and he's one of the world's most accomplished bass players. He's also a composer, a conductor, arranger, and producer. We're going to go back in time and play Sorceress from Return to Forever. This is Stanley Clark's famed fusion jazz band with keyboardist Chick Corea, and this is from a 1976 album, Romantic Warrior. Let's give it a listen. Thank you. and sorceress by Return to Forever, Stanley Clarke's fame fusion jazz band with keyboardist Chick Corea. 76, I don't know, that's several decades ago. Yeah. What's it like for you to listen to that?
Well, like I was telling you, I haven't heard that song in so long. That was a fun band to be a part of, and or just some fun movement. I guess it was called a jazz rock movement originally, then they brought in the word fusion. That band was like a traveling university, you know. We were all learning. Chick was the oldest, but we were still all learning a lot about music and life and how art affects people and how people affect artists, just the whole thing. And it was great because the band had very humble, I mean, extremely humble beginnings. And it went on and, you know, like that record, I think it became a platinum album or something. And we sold a lot of records and we played in front of lots of people. And to be quite honest, we had no idea that was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, because we just wanted to play our instruments good, but we were embraced by people, and that's a great feeling.
Well, as you mentioned, Chick Corea came down and talked to you. You were a teenager,
yeah.
And he said, "Let's do something."
Yeah.
Is this sort of what he had? What you had in mind?
Yeah, Chick was like Chick is exactly almost to the day 10 years older than me, and so he was 28. I was probably 18, and he came down and he says, you know, yeah, let's put something together. And, you know, we didn't talk real specifics about instrumentation. It was more like the concept of, you know, let's make some music that, you know, like that people will like. Because, you know, back in those days, a lot of jazz musicians had their eyes closed. And when I played with Chick, we looked at each other a lot and we thought, yeah, I wonder what that would be like if we had a band where everybody was really alert, really present, you know. And that was sort of the basis of what the band was. And it's funny, that week we played with Joe Henderson at the Aqua Lounge, I think. And what happened was that the piano player with Joe couldn't make it, and so he said, I'm bringing this guy down named Chick Corea. And that's how I met Chick.
Wow.
I knew he had a record out. I heard that he played with Miles Davis. Didn't know that much about him, but we played. And it's funny, we were sitting in my apartment at 19th and Spruce, I think, and we were listening to John Coltrane's The Crescent album and talking about Return to Forever,
wow,
or talking about the future. And that's exactly what happened. Interesting, huh?
It's very interesting. And I, you know, your music got me thinking about the 1970s and what was happening,
yeah,
musically. Some really, I mean, I guess there was disco, but there were some really interesting things going on.
It was nice because it came out of, like, the music in the 60s was so attached to social behavior of this country and other countries. But,
indeed,
you know, going into the 70s, it was kind of a little breath of fresh air and you know, musicians, it was still, you know, people being very sort of revolutionary, being very, you know, involved in making music that was a little bit different or new. And we were just one of them.
Yeah.
And it felt great.
I bet it did.
Yeah.
Kevin, our engineer, wanted to know about, you know, if there was a musician that really had a profound influence on you as a kid,
yeah,
coming up learning,
yeah,
to play the bass.
You know, I remember the day my father bought a, I'm not sure whether it was a stereo system, but it was a record player.
Oh, the old days of the record player, right.
He brought this record player. It was a Motorola. And I remember along with this thing came a demonstration record. And those demonstration records usually had 20 different tracks, and each track was like a minute long. And I was fascinated, first of all, with just the record, with the grooves, and I'm watching, and I'm reading it, and there was this one track that came on by a guy named Chubby Jackson. He was a bass player, and he played this bass solo for, I don't know, a minute. And I was so fascinated by that. And I'm going to learn that solo.
And did you?
And I did. I can still play it today.
And that's Stanley Clark, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. If you want to join our conversation, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. So do you still practice a lot? You said as a kid you probably practice maybe more than you should have. I don't
know. Yeah, well, you know, I'm sort of speaking let's just put it this way. I practiced a lot. My friends that I grew up with always remind me how much I used to practice. Right. And
they want you to come out and do something.
they always remind me of that. But I still practice. I'm working on right now. I'm working on some of the Bach cello suites, the ones that sound good on the bass. I have number one down pretty good, and on number two, and I'm going to record them. And I actually could have played them years ago, but I think it sounds better now because, you know, the pieces were obviously they're written for cello, and you know I'm playing it in the same key that it was written on the cello with the bass, and I just want it to sound really good. I wouldn't want anyone to listen to it and go, well, it's the bass and it's okay, you know. No, I've been really just working on the sound, getting it right, and that'll be out soon.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. So how many basses do you have?
Well, at one point I had hundreds of basses.
Really?
And then I realized, I think when I got in my late 50s, I thought, you know what? I don't think I'm going to be able to play all these basses.
Did you like looking at them, though?
Yeah, it was fun. That was a lot of fun, you know. But what happened was I sold some of them. Just now I probably have maybe, I don't know, 30, maybe a little over that, 30 good basses.
And you play 40. Them all?
You know, not all of them, you know, but I play a lot of them, yeah.
Let me get to, it looks like Kenny from North Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Mm-hmm. Hi, Kenny, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi there. Stanley?
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, you the man.
Okay.
Listen, you inspired me so much because I started playing bass when I was 15.
Okay.
But I never got as good as you.
Don't say that. You know, you're yourself. You know, it's funny, not to cut you off, but, you know, everyone has their own path and their own sound. And someone that's the best or this or that, it's all subjective, you know. If you're happy with what you're doing and if you play in a band and your bandmates are happy with what you're doing, then you're the best, you know. So,
does that work for you, Kenny?
No.
No.
Didn't even make a dent,
no,
right?
Not a dent.
Didn't even make
no.
a dent. Damn, Kenny.
I appreciate the call, though. Kenny, keep on playing. That's what I hear coming from Stanley Clark.
I tried.
You did.
I tried, you know.
I'm going to play another a song. This goes back to a 1984 album of yours, Stanley Clark, mm-hmm. A Time Exposure. Mm. This is Heaven Sent You and is featuring the late George Duke on keys and Howard Hewitt on vocals. Let's give it a quick listen.
This way before, love like an endless feeling, ecstasy forevermore. I want you, I need you, this dream has revealed you. Tonight you'll excite me with your love. This love is creating a time for engaging. Let it be. Be
Again, Heaven Sent, from Stanley Clarke's 1984 album, Time Exposure.
I love that song.
That's a great song.
You know, because when I grew up, you know, one of the things I loved doing was playing really good R&B music. You know, it's I don't think I'll ever stop loving that. It's just what it is, you know. I love good R&B, and Howard Hewitt is a classic R&B singer. So I was really, he's a good friend of mine too, and so it was nice to do something with your friends.
Indeed it is. Well, you do so many things, including work as a producer. I know you worked with Quincy Jones. You worked with George Martin of the Beatles.
Yeah.
What kind of producer are you?
You know, I try to learn from those guys. You know, I think George Martin is one of the greatest. I went down to play on a Paul McCartney record, and Paul's a bass player, but he wanted me to come down and play, do my thing on some song that he had, and I really enjoyed working with George Martin because he was like, he was such a scientist. He was like a mad scientist back there, really smart. Really intelligent. I mean, we had a drummer on that. I'll try to make this short if I can get it so people understand. Basically, there was some question whether the drummer was speeding up. And so, you know, we're trying to figure it out. There was some little slight arguments, and George said in a heavy English accent, he said, "All right, fellow mates, you know, wait, I'll figure this out." So he took the tape, and every time the bass drum came in, he put a little dot on it, and maybe over a certain period of time on the tape. And then he took a ruler out and measured from dot to dot. And then he came back and says, "Our drummer is not rushing at all." I said, "Man, I would have never thought of that."
Yeah.
I would have never thought of it. The guy just, you know, it's back in those days, we didn't have much. But George, he was something. He was and Quincy Jones. I mean, what can you say about him? He's a great friend, Quincy.
And that's Stanley Clarke, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I read somewhere where you talked about the relationship between the bass and the drums. You said something about the drums being the kind of heartbeat or something of a band.
Yeah, I like to tell bass students that when you're in a band, the most important relationship you should have, and this isn't necessarily etched in stone, but let's just say it's scratched in stone. And that's that the most important relationship as a bass player should be with your drummer.
Ah.
You know, that because, you know, the drummer supplies the rhythm. That's his function. The bass player is a person that brings rhythm and harmony together. Those two elements come together. And so so the drums have to be with the bass. And I tell you, I'm very careful what drummers I play with. And there's a lot of good ones there. But I always make sure that, you know, it's kind of like I'm sure you've heard where like certain quarterbacks, you know, at the end of the year, they'll give watches to their linemen who protect them. It's the same thing with the relationship with the drummer. Very important in a band.
Well, Stanley Clarke, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on
Radio
Times.
All right. It was great.
It was great for us as well. And this is the Stanley Clarke Trio, a song, Isotope, from the 2009 album Jazz in the Garden, featuring pianist Hiromi and drummer Lenny White. Let's give it a listen.
Okay.